claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Hey everyone, you may have noticed I am not Dr. Jim Fetzer. My name is Holly Seeliger, and I am filling in for Jim today. While he is a little bit occupied, you might be familiar as to what exactly he's doing today, but we'll follow up on that later. So I've known Jim for several years. I've been a guest on one of his shows, Truth Versus News, for at least a year now. And I also do another weekly show with him on Wednesdays with Joe Olson. So I kind of wanted to talk about the economy and inflation and history. I've been doing a lot of research on American colonial history. Basically for, I don't know, about 10 years or maybe since the last Great Recession, I suppose. And trying to follow up, trying to figure out what is exactly going on as far as currencies and inflation and these cycles that we go through. So I think it's a great opportunity to discuss some of that. And then we'll also get into some current events. There's a lot of big news coming out this week and even today and even in the past couple of hours as far as the Supreme Court. And then the second hour, we are going to take callers. And I've never actually done a show with callers before where I've taken callers. So be kind to me. I think it's going to be fun. So we'll give you the number for that as well. And I'm sure a lot of the regulars already know the number, but we'll jump right into that into the second hour. So you may have heard something called digital cryptocurrencies. You're probably familiar with cryptocurrencies. Maybe you've invested in some of them. Maybe you think it's a big scam. Maybe you've seen how Bitcoin has been jumping and then dipping and then jumping again. A lot of people say that central bank backed digital cryptocurrencies are going to be the future. So this is according to CoinDesk. Jerome Powell of the Federal Reserve says that they plan to recommend to Congress on CBDC, central bank digital cryptocurrencies. So this is completely different from like the decentralized cryptocurrency that we've been sold over the past couple years, especially 10 years, I think. First time I heard of cryptocurrencies was like 2009, maybe. So it's been picking up over the past decade. And we've seen some countries, Jamaica has actually made CBDC, central bank backed digital cryptocurrency, one of their main currencies now. So their Congress or their government, we all know that they're a colony, of course, but they've talked about how they want to make these central bank digital cryptocurrencies part of their money. And we kind of have seen the writing on the wall as far as the cash system and having cash. It's slowly but surely become harder and harder to use cash. We saw that particularly over the past couple of years where cash was marketed as dirty or there were cash shortages or coin shortages. There are even countries, I've heard people talk about how Canada has even gotten rid of pennies and some smaller coins because they're saying that it really isn't even affordable for them to mint these coins anymore. So we are going to see a big shift out of cash. We're already seeing it. So the writing's on the wall as far as that goes. So I wanted to see how far this would actually go back as far as the United States and the minting, printing of coins. There's something called bills of credit. And this was a big lead up to the American Revolution. A lot of people aren't familiar with what really started a lot of this, and then ultimately what happened after the Revolutionary War, the interim period between the Revolutionary War and the Constitution. So there was actually a period of time where we had the Articles of Confederation, and there was a very, very different government here in the United States. And I think that's probably why we don't hear about this form of government and how things really went down as far as bills of credit and the major inflationary periods that we saw after the Revolutionary War, and then leading up to, of course, the creation of the Constitution, the creation of the three branches of government, and then ultimately leading up to the War of 1812, which of course was another war that was centered around inflation and banking, etc. So I do recommend people check out like the Federalist Papers if people want to have a concept of this idea of states' rights versus the federal government, which is interesting because we're actually seeing this today with the Roe v. Wade overturning decision of the Supreme Court, basically just bouncing it back to states. So I know this is a perfect opportunity for people to have another hot summer, if you will. And probably in my mind, it's basically just a cover for the inflation that we are seeing and our currency system completely collapsing, which the Federal Reserve says that they want to basically put out the CBDC in 2023. So my guess is it'll be something like connected to your phone, or they'll have some sort of a debt jubilee tied in with this. And then in exchange, you're basically signing up for a modern bill of credit system. So my focus over the past year or so, I've been presenting on an event called Shays Rebellion, and that took place in Massachusetts in the aftermath of the Revolutionary War. And there was a tremendous inflationary period after the Revolutionary War. So people who actually fought in the Revolutionary Wars and thought that they had gained their freedom, thought that they had fought for years, for 8 years, if they survived against the British, suddenly realized that they were once again basically economic slaves now on their own country, in their own country, and their own states were printing money, but there was nothing backing it, and they were forbidden from using coins. So we saw once again the inflationary period happening in the 1780s, very similar to what we are seeing right now here in the United States. So there's a massive economic turmoil in the aftermath of the Revolutionary War. So after 8 years of massive spending to fund the Revolutionary War, which interestingly enough, the individuals who were, I guess, running or operating, fighting against the British, they were borrowing money from the French, borrowing money from the Spanish, borrowing money even from the British, interestingly enough. So there was a lot of debt, and it was basically bounced back to the states once the war was ended. The states could not keep up with the inflation of the Revolutionary War debt. So, of course, the Americans, the new American citizens, did not really like the idea of suddenly being taxed heavily, since they believed that they had just fought the British in order to end the taxation without representation. So taxation was also unpopular due to the fact that Americans believed that they had fought the war to end the excessive taxation. During the war, several states attained French, Dutch, Spanish, and even British grants and loans to fund the military and supplies. And then there was something called Continental Bonds, which were issued as well. They were created to fund the Continental Army and the Navy. So these were people who were basically signed up to fight in the American Revolution. They signed up and they joined something called the Continental Army and Navy, and they were paid in bonds with the promise that they would actually get American money back once America was established. So these Continental loans were about $5 million in bonds at an interest rate of 6%. So they were borrowing money from the Europeans, which And these central banks, which sounds very familiar to what we are seeing globally right now. And there's also something called the Secret Committee of Correspondence that was created to attain supplies and merchant bills of credit. So these were basically like the upper class of people living in America who were negotiating these bonds and negotiating how all of this would be paid off after 8 years of war. So this led to massive inflationary issues between people who were coming back from the Revolutionary War to find out that they were basically priced out of their own homes. So on top of that, during the Revolutionary War and before that, there was the Navigation Act. So these were acts passed by the British Parliament that imposed restrictions on colonial trade. So British economic policy was based on mercantilism, which was aimed to use the American colonies to bolster British state power and finances. So basically, it ensured that the American colonies would have to deal in tangibles, kind of similar to what we're actually seeing right now with Russia and Europe, etc. So Russia wants to sell their tangible assets, such as gold, such as, wood, oil, everything like that. They're a big exporter of fertilizer. They're a big exporter of even like particle board, stuff that we use for building homes here in the United States, etc. So they're a big exporter of wheat, of other food products. So they actually want to get paid in rubles, right? So this is very similar to what the British did to the American colonies with mercantilism. They said they wanted the American colonies to be bringing in tobacco, to be bringing in wood, to be bringing in furs, rum, sugar, etc. And then they were getting bills of credit, or they had to use British pounds, etc. So it became so rare that the Americans, people within the colonies, could actually deal in British coinage because it was so restricted that they were using Spanish coins, which was more readily available. The Spanish did not have mercantilism or navigation acts, so that's they were using Spanish dollars. So that's why we call them American dollars to this day, because most people within the colonies were actually trading using Spanish coins because of the extreme restrictions that the British put on the American colonists. So the acts inflamed hostilities of American colonists and proved a significant contributing event leading up to the American Revolution. And then mercantilism, as I had mentioned before, talks about the restrictions within tariffs, subsidies for traded goods to achieve goals within the colonies as well. So Adam Smith had coined the term mercantilism system to describe the system of the political economy that sought to enrich the country by restraining imports and encouraging exports. So this started way back in the 1500s when these corporations such as the East India Trading Company and many others were being set up within the American continent in order to ensure that their investors, if you will, were receiving enough of a payout. So mercantilism was based on the idea that a nation's wealth and power were best served to increase exports in an effort to collect precious metals like gold and silver. And it ultimately replaced the feudal system that we saw in Western Europe. So that's why we saw the restriction of specie in the New World. So bills of credit is what they were using in the American colonies, and that's what they were using to pay the American Revolutionary War soldiers and basically anyone involved in the American Revolutionary War. Let's say the troops were marching through your farmland in Virginia or New Hampshire or wherever. They could or would take your land, take your cows, whatever sort of supplies they needed, and say, hey, we need this for the war effort. Here's some bills of credit. However, you're going to have to wait 90 days before you can cash them in, and you can't exchange them for metal currencies such as gold or silver. So Spanish and Portuguese coinage was still available because at the time, the Habsburg Empire of Spain did not prohibit coinage in the New World. Some bills of credit could not be exchanged on demand. Like I said, people had to wait 90 days before they could be cashed in as well. So they put restrictions on when and how they could be used, which I'm just going to remind people, sounds a lot like the central bank digital cryptocurrencies that we are going to be seeing very soon. Bills of credit were the most common in the American colonies. That, like I had mentioned before, Spanish and Portuguese dollars were available. British mercantilism restricted precious metal specie in the colonies. So the Great Britain also outlawed coin minting within the American colonies as well. So people had to use these bills of credit. So the bills of credit actually began as an experiment during the French and Indian Wars. So it's interesting how war is always an impetus to try to use different types of currency or money systems and to pay people this way. I think we have seen this within some of the recent global events where people can donate money or people can send cryptocurrencies to fund troops, etc., fund different events or war efforts even. So this is the, I'm talking about with Shays Rebellion, it was basically the American Revolutionary War veterans saying, we can't afford to buy anything. We can't afford to sell anything at this point. The inflation is so massive using these bills of credit, and they're completely useless, that there was a rebellion within the states. So this was during the era of the Articles of Confederation, which most people forget even existed in American history. So this was part of the taxation without representation era, where the Articles of Confederation granted the central government no power to tax, and the central government had to request money from states, which is very different from what we have today. Also, without the ability to tax, the central government could not borrow money and demand taxes to pay debts. They could not tax an individual, very different from what we see nowadays as well. They could not demand taxes from individuals. They must only appeal to states through a majority vote. So I believe they had to have a supermajority of the American colonies, which were then turned into states. They had to, had to have at least 9 colonies all vote to tax. So that didn't happen during the Articles of Confederation era, which, if you don't know, was between 1781 to 1789. So not a long period of history, but I think it's very substantial that people kind of understand where the American Revolutionary War veterans were coming from, what the original intention of the United States was, and ultimately who kind of took over with the Articles of Confederation to the Federalist Papers. So Hamilton, John Jay, and others really advocating for federalism, which was a stronger federal government system, and ultimately putting in the branch of the president and also putting in the branch of the judiciary. So the Supreme Court, which is big news this week as well. Supreme Court's definitely in the news this week. And then from there, also establishing standing armies, which was something that did not happen before during the Articles of Confederation era. The founding fathers did not like the concept of a standing army. So the establishment of the National Guard, etc., was put into place in order to make sure that local militias were kept in check. So the first set of presidents, which people do not know. So these were the presidents who were before George Washington. People might not be aware. There was John Hanson, Elias Boudinot, Thomas Mifflin, Richard Henry Lee, John Hancock was actually a president. You might not know. Nathaniel Gorham, Arthur St. Clair, and Cyrus Griffin were all presidents before President George Washington. So these presidents, they were basically ribbon cutters. That was the whole point of the presidential role. They didn't really have any control. Like I said, there was no standing army, so they didn't have control over the armies, etc. So with the bills of credit system, North America became the first place in the West to use paper currency. So when I say bills of credit, I'm talking about paper currency, basically, which is something that's not really, during this time, wasn't backed by anything. So when you use something like bills of credit, using that term, means something that does not have any sort of backing. So that's where I am putting this parallel between the central bank-backed digital cryptocurrencies, or CBDC rather. I don't think they're going to be backed by anything. So as opposed to the Russian ruble right now, which is now backed by gold. And I believe last time I checked, this maybe at the beginning of the year, it was like 88 rubles to one US dollar. And now it's something like 55 rubles to one US dollar. So we are seeing a shift right now. United States dollar, what is it really backed by? I mean, it was taken off the gold standard. It was put onto OPEC, right? But we are seeing a major shift in the oil markets right now. So OPEC doesn't really even have the power that it once had. And when we see countries, a strong country like Russia, which has its own infrastructure, I've talked about before how Russia actually went live with its own version of the internet in the summer of 2019. They've been trying to build up their own food supply, their own internet, their own infrastructure outside of the global system, let's just say. So they're becoming more and more independent, whether you're talking about food, energy-wise, imports, exports. Whereas, of course, if you're in the United States, you would know that's certainly not the case here. Within the United States, our infrastructure is basically falling apart. And with inflation, it's showing that there really isn't anything backing the United States dollar. So the bills of credit during the American Revolutionary War also began during the French and Indian Wars. They were designed to pay soldiers and fund the tools of war. So in 1685, Quebec made paper currency basically out of playing card money. So they were using playing cards as an IOU to try to pay mercenaries and soldiers and to build up this war effort. And then paper denominations as payment were given with the agreement that they could be used to pay taxes back to the British at face value for taxes or bond purchases. So, of course, that wasn't the case because there was an interest rate. So people were promised that they would be able to use this to pay their own taxes later. And that was not even the case. So the Revolutionary War debt and speculation occurred, which many people don't know that there was massive speculation even regarding the Revolutionary War debt. So the United States was in massive debt after the Revolutionary War. They owed money primarily to France and also to individual European merchants who were funding mercenaries, who were funding the construction of ships of the American Continental Army and Navy. They're helping with ships and merchants, and the Navy soldiers who came in, they funded troops and ships for battle. Merchants in the colonies borrowed money from merchants in Europe. So there were some super wealthy families in Europe who were funding the wars against mostly like British, trying to fight the British. So this was also a proxy war within Europe. Of course, there were the rich families of France, of Spain, of the Netherlands, who were using their own funds to try to fight the British as well. U.S. merchants demanded hard currency from former Revolutionary War veterans who were paid in bonds during the war. So these merchant families in Europe after the war, they said, okay, we want our debts. We paid you with these bonds and we built these ships, etc. But now we want gold and silver for our investment to help you fight the British. So therefore, that also contributed to massive inflation, which indebted the states in the decade after the war. So the state that was primarily in debt was Massachusetts. So of course, that's the birthplace of the revolution, the Boston Tea Party, etc. The corporations, like I had mentioned before, the East India Trading Company, Massachusetts Bay Colony Corporation. There were a lot of corporations within Massachusetts, and there was a lot of money invested in Massachusetts and a lot of trade there. Of course, the port of Salem and Boston, of course, were massive ports which were engaged in a lot of trade between Europe. So they were heavily indebted. State bills of credit to fund wars. Interestingly enough, though, Salem was actually neutral during the War of 1812. So that kind of gives people a heads up as to which merchant families and individuals who remained neutral during the War of 1812, what really happened with that war. That's probably a topic for another show. To fund the 9 Years' War, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts started printing bills of credit. So this was during the French and Indian Wars. Massachusetts also printed bills of credit for a failed military expedition to invade Quebec. That failed. The French and the British bonds were taken out by Massachusetts to fund years and years of the French and Indian Wars. French and British bonds were taken out by the colonies to fund the American Revolution. And then the Revolutionary War version of the Army had been formed under George Washington on June 14th of 1775, as the Continental Congress decided it was needed in the conflict with Great Britain. The first version of the army, called the Continental Army, as I had mentioned before, worked with state militias on the fight for independence. So on top of the states, such as Massachusetts, printing bills of credit like crazy and just handing them out, which of course, as we are learning now, causes inflation, there were also the private bills of credit, as I mentioned before, where these merchant families were printing their own money as well. So private merchants started issuing their own bills of credit under their own names and the names of corporations in which they started to pay mercenaries and soldiers. Most private bills of credit were not payable on site. Like I said, you had to wait 90 days before you could cash them in. So this became known as IOUs. So you may have heard about, like, the Hessians, for instance, who fought in the American Revolution. Not really discussed too much, but they were mercenaries, and of course they were paid in bills of credit, etc. So people kind of have a simplistic idea of how the American Revolutionary War was fought and the amount of debt and the inflation that occurred because of it, which really set the stage for America. So I know a lot of people, when I give this discussion or talk to people about this, say that the United States wasn't always in debt, etc., but it kind of appears that way to me if you look at just even with the founding of the United States. So we're going to go to break here, and I'll be right back.
Management would like to take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Hey, everyone. It's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
Amazon banned my book so you wouldn't learn what really happened at Sandy Hook. it was a FEMA drill presented as mass murder to promote gun control. Then they sued to shut me up, and the Wisconsin courts played along. I have the proof and the law on my side. What I don't have is the money. They want to do to us what they've already done to Canada. Take guns, impose tyranny. It's on the way with Remington's help. First insurance, then registration, then confiscation. I'm asking SCOTUS to stop it. GiveSendGo.com, funding Fetzer. Check it out. This is for all the marbles.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs. But there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out And Nobody Died in Boston Either. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
Radio every Wednesday 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
All right, everyone, this is not Jim Fetzer. This is Holly Seelger. I'm filling in for Dr. Fetzer today, and I want to thank you for joining me today. I was discussing earlier the inflation and the bills of credit system that led up to Shays' Rebellion, and then ultimately the Federalist Papers, and then the United States Constitution. So there was this strange little period of American history called the Articles of Confederation era, which was about 7 or 8 years or so between the American Revolution and when George Washington was the first president. A lot of people don't really know anything about this time period, and I kind of did a deep dive into this time period because it was interesting to see the parallels between the bills of credit system that was used in the American colonies and what we are seeing today, and probably unfortunately seeing more of as we are being pushed by the Federal Reserve and the central banking conglomerates into the CBDC, the central bank digital cryptocurrency system, which is on its way, and it's already begun in some countries. And I will be taking calls at the start of the second hour. So we're about halfway through here today. So thanks for joining me again. If you do want to see my full presentation on Shay's Rebellion, I also did another presentation on Bacon's Rebellion, which was about the both the Navigation Acts and the mercantilist system and the American colonists and the transition from indentured servitude and the corporations, so corporatism within early America. So the United States was basically founded on a corporate model and these charters, corporate charters, etc. So whether you're talking about like the Plymouth Colony Charter, so the Mayflower Pact, etc., all of these were corporate structures and entities, if you will, with the promise of payout to the signatories of these corporations and the people on the boards of the corporation. So I think this is a very important fact about American history that most people kind of overlook, is the fact that we are founded on the corporate model. And you can kind of see that obviously with how Americans are still treated to this day and how our courts and our financial systems are run. If you can look at it from this concept of indentured servitude, so being entities of the corporation, things start to make a little bit more sense. And then Bacon's Rebellion ultimately led to the expansion of the trade triangle and ultimately the slave model system here in the United States as well. So very fascinating point and part of history. If you want to watch some of my videos on Shay's Rebellion and Bacon's Rebellion, I'm on I still am on YouTube a little bit. I dabble on there. My channel is called Zoon Politikon, Zoon Politikon. And I'm on BitChute, Rumble, Minds, Brighteon. And if you feel like supporting me, I'm also on PayPal, Patreon, etc. And I do 2 weekly shows with Dr. Fetzer at this point. So I know Jim is just so busy. I don't know how he does it all. So I'm filling in for him today because obviously he is a little bit tied up, but I'm sure he'll have lots of news for us very, very soon. So going back to what was leading up to Shay's Rebellion here in the United States. So I was talking about bills of credit and connecting it to the central bank digital model that we are going to, unfortunately, probably be seeing this in the United States as the collapse of the US dollar continues. So private bills of credit, which is what we're basically going to be seeing here in the United States, they were also printed by merchants to fund the building of ships during the Revolutionary War, the transportation of commodities to and from the New World. So as I talked about the corporate model, whether you're talking about the East India Trading Company, or the Plymouth Corporation, Massachusetts Bay Corporation, Connecticut Corporation, they go on and on, Virginia Corporation, all in the New World set up, basically funding these ships, funding the indentured servitude model, which was usually about a 7-year, which has like a biblical reference. You sign on for like 7 years, and then you're supposed to get some freedoms, as in you could get some land, you could get some payment, you could actually get some stock in the company. A lot of times they promised women as well, some sort of job training so that they could actually be a free man afterwards. Sometimes they were promised voting rights as well. So there was a promise of a democratic system. Unfortunately, that didn't really happen, and that's why we did see Bacon's Rebellion, and then also with Shay's Rebellion, and then after that even with the Whiskey Rebellion. And I believe that's when George Washington suspended habeas corpus or something like that in order to put forward the Whiskey Rebellion, suppress that. So people can correct me if you want to call in the second hour. I haven't really done a whole lot of research into the Whiskey Rebellion. That will be my next project as I sort of delve into these different rebellions, because I think they give a better idea as to what Americans were actually fighting than what you're going to see in the history books with the founding fathers, etc., which, don't get me wrong, I think in a lot of ways the Constitution was very forward-thinking. It's how we run our system today, what the Supreme Court uses as their reference, but they were still individuals who had enough money to be able to, they were the upper class Americans. They weren't the poor revolutionary soldiers who were paid in bills of credit and then suddenly found themselves homeless and literally being thrown into debtors' prisons. So they would fight in the American Revolution. If they survived 8 years of the revolution, they found themselves going back into Massachusetts and the state of Massachusetts throwing them in a debtor prison because their bills of credit, in which they had been paid to fight the war, were not being accepted as legal tender in Massachusetts. So Massachusetts was telling people, hey, you can't pay your taxes with bills of credit. You have to pay in gold and silver. And people were saying, we don't even have any gold or silver. You didn't let us use any of that. You paid us in bills of credit. The mercantilist system, the Navigation Acts, prevented people from having any sort of coinage. So that's why their farms were being stolen, their land, and anything that they owned. If they owned crops, it was being taken by the state, etc. So the bills of credit could in theory be redeemed for goods and services after the 90-day waiting period. So the states after the Revolutionary War were in debt to war bonds to fund troops and munitions, state bills of credit. So like I said before, Massachusetts, Virginia, the 13 original colonies, all of them got into debt to fund their own militias. And then on top of that, the private bills of credit, the merchant system, the merchant class, we refer to them in a lot of cases as like the Boston Brahmin. You can still research these families. I think there still is a Wikipedia page of the Boston Brahmin. You can type in Boston Brahmin. And it's these same families who owned these corporations going way back to the Mayflower Compact, which is pretty fascinating if you look at some of these families and individuals who, let's say, are on the board of like the local Federal Reserve Board. A lot of them are family members of these original Boston Brahmin families who are also signatories of a lot of these, like the Mayflower Compact or these other corporate charters, which were meant to distribute commodities from the New World to Europe. So during the war, massive printing of bills and credit and the bonds led to inflation as these credits actually became useless. So these bills of credit had even less value if they were not payable on site, which I said it, for the most part, there was a 90-day waiting period. So if you try to trade them in, a lot of storefronts would say, no, I don't want these because I'm going to have to wait 90 days or however many days before I can use them. By 1775, massive military spending was needed to support the Revolutionary War, and the Continental Congress was assembled to start issuing IOUs as well. So the Continental Congress kind of ran the money system and everything. It was kind of like an interim government before the Articles of Confederation. So British merchants began printing counterfeit IOUs on top of this and distributing them throughout the colonies. This also contributed to inflation. So this was a form of economic warfare that the British were using because they were just printing a ton of counterfeit Massachusetts bills of credit, IOU, etc. And then land and resources were taken by farmers and civilians by the Continental armies during the war, and they were paid in the IOUs. And also the Continental soldiers were paid in IOUs. So by the 1780s, most storekeepers had stopped even accepting IOUs and bills of credit. So there were some, like what we're seeing right now, the equivalent to like the toilet paper runs or shortages or like the baby food shortages. There started to be like some infrastructure collapse by the 1780s in the United States just because of the shortages and the inflation as well. In the aftermath of the American Revolution, massive inflation also caused the legislature in the states to attempt to tax the citizens to pay the bills of credit, which were being purchased by the merchant class. So the merchant class, the upper class, who had printed a lot of the IOUs, were demanding that the states pay them back, and they were demanding gold and silver. So the states actually started to tax the individuals living in the state, saying, hey, we need to pay off all this debt. And of course, if you're a Revolutionary War soldier and you survive the 8 years of the war, you're going to start wondering, hey, why are my taxes going up? I thought I just fought a war to stop all of this taxation. So state and federal governments were petitioned by the merchants who are buying the bonds and bills of credit to be paid off in tangible assets, both specie and property. And then, however, like I said during the Articles of Confederation, if the central government wanted to tax, they had to ask the states, and the states were obviously saying no. So most states started allowing notes to be paid off for much less and also attempted to consolidate their debt. So this is where we're seeing like the derivatives markets that we're seeing right now, obviously not as insane as we see here in the United States right now, but there did start to be some like derivatives markets because the merchants were buying up as these IOUs and the bills of credit were becoming less and less valuable. The merchant class was buying them up super cheap and then demanding that the states pay them back in gold and silver. So the veterans of the Continental armies were the ones who were really taking the brunt of all this inflation. So one of these individuals, which of course Shays Rebellion is named after, was someone named Daniel Shays, and he was a rural farmer living in Western Massachusetts, which of course Western Massachusetts was and is the more rural part of the state. The most of the wealth is concentrated on the coast, in Boston, Salem, etc., where these major ports were and where these merchant families were. Shays joined the local militia during the Revolutionary War, fought in multiple battles, including Bunker Hill, Saratoga, Lexington, as a captain in the 5th Massachusetts Regiment. So he was never actually paid for his services. He was paid in bills of credit as well. So he was taken to court by the local government. He returned home to rural Brookfield, Massachusetts, only to find out that he was being taken to court on account of unpaid taxes on his land, which had accumulated while he was fighting in the war. He had no way of paying. They wouldn't take his bills of credit. They wanted him to pay in gold and silver. So a lot of people were actually just bailing the states after this and heading out west. So there was a big concern, and this was something I had covered as well in my presentations on Bacon's Rebellion, where these corporations who had brought in all these indentured servants, and in the case during Shays Rebellion, they had all these suddenly tax-paying citizens squatting, leaving, going native, if you will. There was a major concern that people would join the Native American tribes, they would become frontiersmen, they'd stop paying taxes, and they would head west. So this was a major issue and a major concern for the corporations. And then as the Revolutionary War progressed, it became a major issue of the states, which needed to maintain their tax base. And obviously they were having difficulty with the Native Americans as far as paying taxes. That was completely foreign to them. They were not considered citizens. They were under common law, which a lot of people don't understand, that until the Native Americans became part of the, they basically had to sign fealty to the crown. So they tried to do this during Bacon Rebellion era, where they would start to have these Native American zones where they would offer the Native Americans land and reservation status in exchange for swearing fealty to the crown system. So then they were given citizenship under this legal system, and they were no longer considered under common law. So basically, that's what the French and Indian Wars were about, of course, was either getting the Native Americans, who were free people, they were under common law, to either sign up under these corporate charters, become citizens of the crown, start paying taxes, etc. And if they didn't, then they needed to be annihilated. And so they were paying poor indentured servants and people, they would promise them freedom. They would pay them in bills of credit and have them fight in the French and Indian Wars to go and either convert these Native Americans, if you will, by force, or completely genocide the Native Americans in order to get them into this corporate model. So very different view of the United States and what the purpose was and why so many people were concerned about squatters on the frontier of Western Massachusetts within this idea of Shays' Rebellion. So there were fear of people just generally going native in Western Massachusetts, rebelling from taxation. And of course, the Articles of Confederation lacked any sort of centralized power to enforce taxation. It was still pretty much voluntary in a lot of cases. So Massachusetts started jailing anyone for failure to pay taxes, including outlaws on the frontier. They started trying to round up people who were going native. Taxation became difficult with free citizens living on native land and going native under common law. And then the Land Ordinance of 1785 was established, passed by the United States Congress under the Articles of Confederation. It laid out the process by which lands west of the Appalachian Mountains were to be surveyed and sold. And then that way, these people who were formerly squatting in the Appalachian Mountains or west could therefore be legally taxed once this land was surveyed. The method of creating townships and sections within townships was used for all U.S. land after 1785. So it was an attempt to stop people from going native and living under common law. And so there was something called Article 4 of the Articles of Confederation, quote, "The better to secure and perpetuate mutual friendship and intercourse among the people of the different states of this union, the free inhabitants of each of these states, paupers, vagabonds, and fugitives from justice excepted, shall be entitled to all privileges and immunities of free citizens in several states." So that was a big part of it, and it continued to be until the whole West was won, was people, the concern of people just going native or going west and not paying their taxes. So the Massachusetts bills of credit issue really came to a head around 1790. Inflation got out of control and the state actually started to collapse in a lot of ways. To curb inflation, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts legislature decided to attempt to get out of debt by 1790. They started to call in their bills of credit and started issuing new bills of credit notes, one for veterans and one for everyone else. This just caused mayhem because they were basically just putting more bills of credit out there. So kind of reminds me of what we are seeing right now with like the gas vouchers, and, you know, we've got people on EBT and food stamps and TANF, and we're going to give you, you know, some money for the lockdowns and some money for inflation and, you know, PPP money, and just like printing a bunch of money and expecting that it's going to make any difference ultimately with the growing inflation. So Massachusetts declared that all debt must be paid in gold and silver to the merchants who are buying up the debt from the bills of credit. So that caused another issue. Like I said, people were just being straight up thrown into debtors' prisons, which we're not exactly at that point yet here in American history, but I don't know how you bleed, you know, water from a stone at this point as far as people being in debt. So taxation to pay off the war debt. So Massachusetts also instituted a heavy tax upon all landowners and a further tax upon all males age 16 and older, regardless of work or land or voting status. So this is when things started to go nuts in Massachusetts, because let's say you were a Revolutionary War veteran, you had six sons, you know, all living on your land. All of them had to pay taxes to Massachusetts on this, and all of them had to pay in gold and silver. So by 1780, all bills of credit notes in Massachusetts had been bought up by merchant speculators in and around Boston. So this is where I'm talking about the derivative market. So 80% of the debt was in Boston with the, like I call them, the Boston Brahmin families, basically, and was owned by just 35 men. Nearly all were in the state legislature. One was governor. And all of these purchasers of the debt were also individuals who ultimately funded the mercenaries needed to squash Shay's rebellion when the militia refused. So they tried to send the militia, the local state militia, after these Revolutionary War veterans who were rebelling, and even the local militia refused, and a lot of cases joined the veterans. And that was a big reason why the Federalist Papers actually argued that there needed to be a central government and there needed to be standing armies in order to go against and, you know, break up any sort of sedition or rebellion after using Shay's Rebellion as an example. So with these debtor prisons in 1785, as I had mentioned before, John Hancock, who had actually served as president at one point, he retired from his position of governor of Massachusetts, leaving Massachusetts under the ruling of Governor James Bowdoin. So Bowdoin was one of these individuals who had bought up a lot of this credit in Massachusetts at low, low prices, and then was demanding gold and silver in return. Bowdoin reversed Hancock's decision to not prosecute citizens guilty of not paying back taxes. He initiated civil action to prosecute those who had unpaid taxes, collect delinquent taxes, as well as raising state taxes, and he started to institute debtors' prisons in Massachusetts for people who weren't paying. So the farmers and the veterans actually started to appeal to the Massachusetts courts. They actually went through the court system. They tried to pass local tax reforms. They tried to change the rules on how the governor was selected. They tried to remove the legislature from Boston. They tried to repeal the Massachusetts Senate. And so they had tried several different ways in order to stop the inflation. So ultimately, several groups of veterans and the working class started assembling locally, calling themselves regulators, because all they wanted to do was regulate the massive inflation and the taxation that was going on in Massachusetts. So the rebellion happened from 1786 to 1787, and they were quashed by a private mercenary army, and ultimately led to the Constitution and to the standing armies that we see today. So we're going to do some call-ins here in just a minute, the second hour. So we've got a call-in number. If people want to try to call in here, it's 540-352-4452. So you can call on this topic or whatever you like. It would be nice to speak with you. Thanks, guys. We're going to follow up here.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs. But there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out And Nobody Died in Boston Either. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
If you think for 1 second that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourselves. Because we know who they are and what they do. This is what they do, and we must fight back. You can torture us and bomb us, fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. But time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet, not giving up. Revolution Radio.
Amazon banned my book so you wouldn't learn what really happened at Sandy Hook. It was a FEMA drill presented as mass murder to promote gun control. Then they sued to shut me up, and the Wisconsin courts played along. I have the proof and the law on my side. What I don't have is the money. They want to do to us what they've already done to Canada. Take guns, impose tyranny. It's on the way with Remington's help. First insurance, then registration, then confiscation. I'm asking SCOTUS to stop it. GiveSendGo.com, funding Fetzer. Check it out. This is for all the marbles.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
All right. I think we are back here for the second hour. I'm filling in for Dr. James Fetzer today. My name is Holly Seeliger. And I'm not exactly sure how this works with people calling in, but we do have a number here, 540-352-4452, if people feel like calling in. And I think you'll just kind of join the chat here. And if you've got comments or questions, if you want to talk about what I was discussing earlier as far as bills of credit, inflation, and you'll just join the call if you call in. And we could talk about that. We could talk about history of the United States, or we could talk about something completely different. I'm pretty open to any of that. I know a lot of people have comments. We've got a really intelligent community, a great group of people who are frequent listeners and frequent callers, and just really great community of people who are highly intelligent and informed. So really happy that I'm able to share with you some of my research both on Shay's Rebellion and the inflation, because I think it's important that people understand that inflation is a system. It is a tool that is used, and it's not just something that just happens, you know, just financial mismanagement, you know, like Janet Yellen saying, I didn't really know that this inflation was going to happen. We had no idea. And it's always kind of funny to me that when you see, I've seen this recently, I guess, with like a collapsing system, if you've got a company that's about to go belly up or something, or in the case of the Federal Reserve, you will put like a woman in charge. And I don't know if it's just because, you know, when you see like a failing company or something, you have a woman in charge, people aren't as harsh or something, if there's like a woman in charge, or like what the point of that is. Just like my own observation, I guess, as a woman, is that they'll put a woman in charge to be like, oh, well, we didn't know, or it was mismanagement, or Janet Yellen saying, oh, I didn't know that inflation was going to go on for this long, or it's going to be this bad, despite all the money printing and nothing backing the United States dollar at this point, which I think people are finally starting to realize. If you're talking about gas prices, particularly food prices, like I've seen in my own life, in my own grocery shopping and budgeting and whatnot, just trying to get food, in some cases, some products that I had purchased just in January, the price has doubled. The price has literally doubled since January. So we're talking about, what, a 6-month period, and things have doubled. And I don't know if people are just ignorant, or they want to stick their head in the sand, or there's a lot of people who are still pretty quiet about this. And, you know, I lurk on social media. I don't put anything of consequence on those types of platforms really anymore, because I just feel it's either like trolls at this point, or what are you going to do, like argue with your own friends and family and like split up your family over this sort of stuff at this point? I think people have made up their minds. There's been a line in the sand drawn. We are seeing a literal split of society, of our perceptions of reality, I think. And I think this is why I like to look at history and economics and geopolitics from a larger, like a macro perspective, because you start to see, like, for instance, the money magic, if you will, the belief that people have in the monetary system. And I think that's why I wanted to discuss bills of credit. Other people have discussed this to a degree as well. I like the work of Catherine Austin Fitz. She talks about the company store, like the company credit. There's like that song, like I sold my soul to the company store, because there were people, like I said, as the United States moved further and further west, these corporations, and you see like the wagon trains and the funding, the different banks and the individuals. Like, I did a video recently about JP Morgan Chase, and they just laid off at least 500 people this week. It's going to be a lot more. But if you look at the history of Chase, the history of the Morgan families, all of this goes way back as far as funding the Civil War, funding the West, and pretty fascinating as far as the funding of the United States. So, yeah, and then I'm getting a comment as well that the Supreme Court, as I had mentioned a little bit earlier, they bounced back the Roe v. Wade decision back to the states this morning. So before the articles, before the Constitution, when I was discussing the Articles of Confederation system, the federal government had no control. They were basically, it was made up of the Confederation of the states. So even under the Articles of Confederation, Canada could join. It was basically like a bunch of states agreeing to work within each other. They were their own autonomous economies. They had their own money systems. They didn't have the sorts of, let's say you were wanted for a crime in one state, another state didn't have to give you up. There was no system. So if you committed a crime in Massachusetts and you fled over the border to Rhode Island, there, Massachusetts couldn't go to Rhode Island and say, hey, you need to hand this guy over. He was basically free as long as you were in this other state, because it was its own government at that point. So the federal government had no control over that. And then, like I said, with Shay's rebellion as well, when that, after that rebellion started to kick off, the merchants actually funded their own militia to try to squash the veterans in Shay's Rebellion. So Shay's Rebellion was a bunch of veterans and paupers and regular people in Massachusetts who didn't have the coinage to pay their taxes, and they started to go to the local garrisons and started to arm themselves, and they shut down the court systems in Massachusetts and said, you need to shut down these debtor prisons, you have to stop taxing people to death, which they were literally doing. You got to stop this inflationary system, the printing of money. So then these individuals, these merchants who had printed all these IOUs and had bought them up through these derivatives markets, funded their own militia to squash the rebellion, and then started to appeal to George Washington and said, hey, we need a constitutional convention. We need to meet in Philadelphia. We need something more organized and more formal, if you will. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. We need a standing army. We need a court system. So just some thoughts about this. So I do think with the Roe versus Wade, we are seeing actually, which I think is kind of fascinating, which we see this with this, the establishment of the Supreme Court. And this is the whole point of the United States, is because you have these corporations, and then you have the states, and then you have like a township government, and we have sheriffs, and we have governors. And during the colonial era, governors had a lot of power, and they were funding a lot of the merchant ships. They had massive amount of control. And then we saw this recently with the lockdowns, that it did appear as if the role of the governor basically had, they could shut down, they could issue mandates, and they could shut down entire states, and they could try to block interstate travel or whatever they threatened to want to do. So it would have to go through the court system ultimately for all of this to be ruled unconstitutional. And we're seeing the value of the Supreme Court now, as far as the ebb and flow between giving the federal government more power and sometimes giving the states more power. So ultimately, I know some people might disagree with me, and you could call in if you would like, and we could have that discussion. But I think ultimately the role of the reversal, if you will, of Roe versus Wade is that as far as the number, let's just say, of abortions that happen in the United States, I don't think that's really going to change, because the states have already kind of drawn a line in the sand as far as which states will allow it and which won't. Like, obviously people will still be able to get an abortion in California or New York, and that's where the majority of them happen anyway. So I think as far as statistics go, it's not going to change that much, but it does offer a precedent by saying that this is up to the state. So it does, in this instance, give more power back to the states. And I believe, as I think it was Justice Roberts who had stated in his decision, Samuel Alito, pardon, he lashed out at liberals in guns case, also with tensions boil over at SCOTUS. So this is just me just reading a headline off of CNN today. So CNN is completely flipping out right now. Roe v. Wade overturned. And obviously, we've seen a lot of discussion about possibly adding more seats to the Supreme Court, so, which has happened in the past, adding more seats, you know, what they call stacking the court or whatnot, and changing the makeup of the court, like I said. In some cases, some decades or some centuries, the Supreme Court rules on the side of federalism, and in other decades or centuries, they rule more in the case of states' rights. And I do think in this case, with the makeup of the Supreme Court right now, we are seeing a push towards more individual and states' rights, which I think is a welcome swing, just because things have just gone kind of crazy, as you might have seen over the past few years, as far as the federalist model, I'll just call it, so, versus the individual or even the state. So just some thoughts about that off the top of my head, connecting this to what we're seeing with Roe v. Wade overturned. So the Supreme Court basically saying that there is no explicit right to an abortion in the Constitution, which in that case, that is correct. The word abortion is not used in the Constitution versus, let's say, like the Second Amendment with like right to bear arms or other sorts of quote unquote rights of the Constitution. So, and it was even more so, like I said, during the Articles of Confederation era, you weren't given rights by a federal government. There was, the federal government had no power to begin with. So, you know, they had to appeal to the states and ask for money and ask for any sort of organization or backing, etc. So they couldn't even tax the individual, as I had mentioned before, which is extremely different from what we see today with the individual taxes that we pay, and probably don't want to fall down too far into that rabbit hole as far as the taxing of the individual. I do think we are going to see a big shift in that as well, but with like the central bank digital cryptocurrency model, everything is instantaneous, so taxes could be just pulled out right, you know, in the moment. So just as soon as you are engaging in any sort of online transaction, the tax could be pulled out. And what are you going to do to try to appeal that? There's really nothing you can do. So there's no paying taxes on the back end. They're probably just going to pull it out and just say, this is what you owe, like in real time, basically. So let's see, do we have, let me give out this number again. Our number is 540-352-4452 if anyone feels like joining us today. So I'll give a little bit of a breakdown as to what actually happened when Shay's Rebellion turned hot. So on September 5th, 1786, it began and it continued through January 25th of 1787. So on September 5th, the court of Worcester, Massachusetts was shut down by these individuals called the regulators. So they were sick of the courts ruling to throw people in jail and take their land, take their property in exchange for not paying taxes. So when Governor Bowdoin summoned the militia to intervene, the Massachusetts militia disobeyed and actually joined the regulators. So this really shook up the upper classes because they had established these militias with the hope and the expectation that they would be there to really uphold and protect the wealthy, let's just say, as we see to this day, as Smedley Butler and others have discussed before with these, like, let's say the fruit wars or something like that, where a lot of people who are in the army or in these mercenary type situations ultimately realize that they're doing the bidding of the corporations in a lot of situations, not really protecting freedom or democracy, spreading democracy around the world, more like with the fruit wars, etc. They were making sure that, what was it, Dole, I think, and Chiquita or something like that, the fruit corporations could control the supply and demand and their assets and their investments of the corporations, which, as I had said before, that's what the United States was founded on, right? You're talking about rum and sugarcane and tobacco. And this was even before cotton. You know, cotton was a big export at one point, but really the British put a lot of cotton into India as well. So it was never really as big as, like I said, rum and sugarcane and tobacco. And I did a recent video, a recording with author Scott Dawson. And he has done extensive research and actually archaeology regarding Hatteras Island and the lost colony of Roanoke. And also I did a recording with him, which I will be uploading onto YouTube and BitChute, other platforms this weekend, discussing Blackbeard and discussing piracy. And people might not think that this has anything to do with what I'm discussing. But actually, if you look at what happened with, let's say, Shay's Rebellion, that's what was happening with people on land. Well, at sea, people were turning to piracy because you were basically a slave on these merchant ships. A lot of times you were even kidnapped and put on these ships. So these private merchant, you know, marine type situations where you're put onto these massive ships, you're taking the goods and services, you're shipping them all around the world, the tobacco, the rum, the sugar cane, and then you're getting paid in bills of credit. So let's say you get onto a ship in Massachusetts and you're part of the East India Trading Company and you're basically a slave on the ship for 2 years and you get paid in bills of credit. Well, your ship docks in Florida, the state of Florida isn't going to use the Massachusetts bills of credit. It's basically useless. So they couldn't even buy anything. So they're working poor. They're slaves on these ships. They were treated horrendously. The punishments were severe, including torture and death. So, yeah, if they were given the opportunity to go rogue, and sometimes they were privateers, which basically means that they were given a permission slip from a governor or from the king even or a corporation to say, okay, you guys can raid French ships or you can raid Spanish ships, etc. So a lot of these pirates started off as privateers and then they went rogue. So if you were a poor sailor on one of these ships on, let's say, the East India Trading Company, you had the opportunity to go rogue and become a pirate, you could be paid in gold and silver. You could be paid in the booty, which you were involved in stealing. So you could be paid in sugarcane or rum, etc., which, you know, of course, contributed to the difficult lifestyle of being a pirate to be paid in rum. But at least it was something that you could utilize or drink or trade versus a bill of credit, which if you were a legit law-abiding sailor, you couldn't use it anywhere. The inflation was absolutely massive. You were treated horribly. And as Scott Dawson in our discussion went on to describe, there was basically a pirate colony on the island of Nassau at one point during the golden age of piracy. And there was a form of democracy. People could vote for who was going to be the captain, etc. There was some oversight and some belief in camaraderie, you know, as an individual, as a pirate. So, yeah, given the opportunity, wouldn't you rather be a pirate than basically a slave to these corporations on these ships and probably not even survive? You know, they were treated so terribly. The scurvy and everything like that was super common because they weren't getting the food and the sustenance. They were living off of like hardtack on these ships. And obviously they weren't going to keep like good food on the ships because all of that needed to be available for cargo. So just some thoughts about that is why the golden age of piracy and why the punishment for piracy was so severe, because they did pose an extreme threat in a lot of ways to the corporate model, to the corporations themselves, because individuals like Blackbeard would have, like, I think Dawson said at one point he had like 700 people under his crew, as part of his crew. And that's massive, even by today's standard, to have a crew of over 700. So talking about dozens of ships. So looks like we've got a caller in here. Hello.
Yes. Hey, it's Paul, California. I was listening with interest most of the way. It's quite a bit of information you've accumulated there. And the thought that occurred to me was that people have to be protected from what I'll call human greed and human avarice. That's a good word. You know, the schemes of others. And, you know, corporation or no, you know, there's always men organized behind corporations to exploit and take advantage of essentially decent, innocent people. And I think we're looking at something very similar today. You know, the very structure of society, the very structure of our government and corporations, in many ways is in conflict with the basic desires of most of humanity to live with a certain amount of freedom and dignity. So it's there's so many issues that you've raised with all the different things. It seems like you've got a little bit of a reading list behind you. Is there a couple of books you would recommend on the Revolutionary War in those times?
Well, you kind of put me on the spot here. I do have a few books. There's one called The Governor and the Rebel, and that's about Bacon's Rebellion. That's a more recent book that was quite thorough. And there's a book called Pax Americana, which talks about the treatment of American Revolutionary War soldiers and early.
It's called Pox,
as
Pax,
in smallpox.
Right, right. Interesting.
So it kind of you mentioned that topic as well.
You mentioned Shay's Rebellion quite a bit too. That was interesting.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember which books I had. I think I put them. I actually tried to organize and put some of it back on my shelf. It was actually kind of hard to find some information, particularly on that, because it was so short lived. It was really only a few months. There's a few good lectures that you can find on YouTube on Shay's Rebellion. I know that's not like the most professional reference there, but there is a book called Shay's Rebellion that I had referenced. I think his name is, Leonard. I know his first name is Leonard Shay's Rebellion. Let me see if I can look it up here. Leonard Richard.
Yeah. Okay. And just so you know, I mean, I obviously wasn't trying to put you on the spot. I was just curious because, like I said, there's always lots and lots of material out there that, you know, let's face it, the average person isn't even aware of, much less, you know, had contact with.
I had to go through some really old books, too, like books about, like, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and, like, look up the economy structure of some of this stuff. So it's not really spelled out if, as you have already kind of described, it's not something that is really put into like a timeline for people to get an idea about.
Right. Right. The whole history of money is quite interesting though. I mean, in terms of what you were referring to with the bills of credit, and it just is quite amazing when you think about how ancient it is, where, you know, people are taken advantage of by various schemes. And when you look at it today, it's, you know, very similar. There's all these various schemes are being used to essentially get over on people, to take advantage of their naivete or their lack of knowledge of commerce, or, you know, the term that he used quite a bit earlier was mercantilism. I thought that was pretty interesting, very well done. Hey, I was just curious, in mentioning corporations so much, have you seen a video, which I believe you can still see on YouTube, called The Corporation Nation Master?
Look, I will bring up
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, and we'll be right back after this message.
Management would like to take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Oh,
Join Revolution Radio every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
Even the government admits that 9/11 was a conspiracy. But did you know that it was an inside job, that Osama had nothing to do with it, that the Twin Towers were blown apart by a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes, that Building 7 collapsed 7 hours later because of explosives planted in the building? Barry Jennings was there. He heard them go off and felt himself stepping over dead people. The U.S. Geological Survey conducted studies of dust gathered from 35 locations in Lower Manhattan and found elements that would not have been there had this not been a nuclear event. Ironically, that means the government's own evidence contradicts the government's official position. 9/11 was brought to us compliments of the CIA, the neocons of the Department of Defense, and the Mossad. Don't let yourself be played. Read America Nuked on 9/11. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Hi, everyone. This is Holly Seeliger. I'm filling in for Dr. James Fetzer today. You can find me on several platforms at Zoon Politikon, ZoonPolitikon. And you can support me through PayPal if you would like, through holly.seeliger@gmail.com. My name is spelled holly.seeliger@gmail.com. So I'm filling in for Jim. I've known Jim for a couple of years now, doing a couple of shows a week with him. And we are also joined in our chat by Paul. So thanks, Paul, for holding during the break.
Sure. The question I had asked was, there's a documentary film called The Corporation Nation Master, made by Clint Richardson. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
No, I've heard of Clint Richardson over the years. I know he's got several books out, but I've never actually seen it. It's a documentary.
You must watch it. It's quite compelling. In fact, I consider that to be your marching orders after this show
right.
is over. It's 3 hours, so
it's quite
involved, but. You won't be the same afterwards. And essentially, I mean, he goes into the whole corporate nature of everything we're looking at today, including, of course, all governments, all these various governments of various sizes, are all municipal corporations, cities, towns, states, et cetera. But the most revealing thing, of course, is how they have been, all of them, but essentially the larger ones, of course, have been hoarding money, stealing money, sequestering money from us, yet continuing to hold their hand out collecting taxes. And it goes right with what's known as the CAFR, Comprehensive Annual Financial Reports. I'm sure you've heard of those. And that most people don't look at, much less even know exist, but they're actually public. And he's examined them in detail many, many times. And he covers them in the film, The Corporation Nation Master, which I think was about 2010 or 2011, if I'm not mistaken. And I believe you can still see it on YouTube. I know it was still there probably 6 months or so ago, but I took a look at it again. But sections of it require more than one viewing. I've looked at the whole thing through probably twice. But it is absolutely mind-boggling how much money, for example, just certain states like California or Florida have essentially collected, if you want to be kind and use the word collected, in terms of taxes. that people never see again, and it doesn't go to buy anything or you know, pay for anything or provide any goods or services for the people of the state. It's just used to continue to make money and amass wealth. It's the most amazing thing you can possibly imagine, but it probably doesn't surprise you, and it probably wouldn't surprise most people.
Well, that sounds really fascinating. Yeah, it reminds me of what I had mentioned before with Catherine Austin Fitz talking about when she had worked. I think she was like Secretary of HUD or something like that, and she talked about the missing trillions of dollars. So obviously, when you're talking about corporations and individuals like the super wealthy at this point, it's not even really about them amassing wealth as much as like oppressing people, it seems like, you know, like taxation as a form of like psychological abuse even.
Yeah, it's a interesting point you just made there. I wasn't sure what you were going to follow up when you said it's not even about them amassing wealth. I wasn't sure what was coming next, but immediately came to my mind. It's more about keeping it from us. Okay, what they don't want us to have in general is abundance, or they don't want us to have the prosperity from the fruits of our creativity, our productivity, our hard work. You know, they're going to keep all of that. And that's actually now, of course, all being weaponized against us. There was a man, and I forget his name, he's probably gone now, but he made a name for himself. He made a little bit of a stink bringing these comprehensive annual financial reports out into the open and publicizing what was going on. And he actually did some calculations, which I thoroughly believe I never looked into or checked, but I believe he was down in Orange County, California. But he actually made a pest of himself at various Board of Supervisors meetings down there. And he made public the fact that Orange County, just as a county, would been able to operate for 11 years or more without taking a penny in taxes. That's how much money they had saved and basically sequestered. And a lot of these large corporations, be they counties, cities, states, employ their own financial management firms or teams to essentially make money on their money. And so therefore depriving the people that have paid the taxes of whatever it was they were supposed to be taxed for, but also depriving them of the profits of the investments. It's similar to the way insurance companies do today. People never see the benefits of their premiums. They just pay them. And unless you make a claim against your insurance company, you're never going to get anything for that money. And with taxes, it's a very similar situation. Florida and California were amazingly egregious and exposed in this film, The Corporation Nation Master, where, for example, I believe the comprehensive annual financial report for one of those states, you know, take your pick, was 1,200 plus pages. 1,200 pages to list all the financial investments and programs and assets. And I like to make the joke, the average person walking around, the average man or woman that's working, probably wouldn't need more than a page for their financial report. And yet these corporations that, you know, hold sway over them, or at least in terms of taxation, they need hundreds and hundreds of pages to list all their assets, which are in many cases are just performing for those who control them. As I said, not for the benefit of those who paid the money that has been removed from circulation for all purposes.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. If you're looking at something like California or Massachusetts or like Michigan, one of these states which tax their people heavily, they have some of the worst roads and, you know, worst infrastructure, bridges falling apart. But that's always the first argument that people make. Well, I need to pay my taxes because that's how the roads get fixed, or that's how, you know, things get done, right? So, yeah,
exactly. I know.
Hopefully, you know, the normies, if you will, are starting to realize maybe that's not where my taxes are going. Where is this money going?
You know, I've had many interesting discussions / arguments with people over the years about the income tax, which earlier in the show you said was maybe a road, you know, that you didn't necessarily want to go down. But yeah, everybody, their go-to, you know, shall we say, argument, and they're just repeating what it is they've already been brainwashed to believe. But their go-to argument is, oh, what about the roads? What about this? What about that? And I always used to say, and it's a fun experiment if you ever want to have it, is you just look at them and you say, okay, fine. What roads aren't paid for, and what's the balance? You know, these are questions I want to know. Tell me which roads you claim or which bridges are not already paid for, and in many cases paid for many times over, and what's the balance due? Tell me that. But, you know, most of these people, they don't know anything. You know, they're just essentially regurgitating in their minds the reason for their servitude. That's the frustrating thing.
Right. And that is exactly what I was saying. Basically, with the states under the Articles of Confederation, the individual was not to be taxed. That didn't make any sense in that system. That wasn't occurring. And it was the states, if the states wanted to contribute to a federal coffer, if you will, they would, which some states did and some states didn't. But with the Articles of Confederation, there was a way for states to be taxed. And then you just kind of piqued my interest here. It appears as though the first time there was any sort of an individual tax, it was in 1861. When states started to create an income tax system in order to fund for the Civil War. And then, of course, the federal income tax came in later, which a lot of people have argued is not technically constitutional, I suppose, either. So I think we are going to see a really big restructuring, though, with like the central bank cryptocurrency and all that. Have you heard anything about that, or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, lots of rumors about what's coming and when it's coming. I've been hearing about it since the 80s, not necessarily cryptocurrency, but hearing about, you know, the financial takeover and control using, you know, digital currency. This has been something that's been kicked around for the better part of 40 years. So it's sort of like, okay, they keep hanging it over our heads and we'll see. But yeah, more specifically on the income tax, which I believe is an interesting discussion to be had, and a lot of people don't understand it. You may not be aware, but the Supreme Court first ruled, I think there was more than one ruling, but one of the first rulings against the income tax, which you're calling a tax on the individual, but of course it's actually a tax on persons. They don't actually tax a man or a woman. They're taxing you as a person.
Good point.
But the first ruling came in the 1890s, and you know why the Supreme Court, it's interesting. Do you know why the Supreme Court ruled that it was unconstitutional at that time?
No.
Essentially because they said that you cannot tax a man's income because there's really no way to separate the income from the man. In other words, to say, okay, I tax your quote income or your money. Well, if an individual had an absolute right to his own, you know, person, his own property, his own labor, which is his property, then there was no separating of that thing that they were trying to call income from the man himself. And so therefore it would operate as a capitation tax, or what they call a head tax. It's a tax on, you know, you, in other words, like you're counting heads. Okay, so all these different heads, right? You owe me. That's what they essentially said. And nothing has really ever changed since then. There's various ways they've camouflaged and disguised it, but the whole thing's voluntary. I can tell you that right now. You assess yourself, you use their tax tables to figure out what it is you owe, you sign your return, right? And you send it in, or when you sign a W-4, W-2, you basically give them permission to withdraw from your pay, you know, what it is you say is okay for them to withdraw, as opposed to just claiming exempt, which is what I've done over the years. I've done many, many, many times. You just claim exempt and they don't take out federal or state withholding.
Right. That's interesting. I've noticed, though, if you, let's say, I'm from like the generation of like student loan debt. So for them to assess like how much I pay in student loans or something like that, I am supposed to, I don't know if I have to, but I have to provide like a W-2, or I have to provide proof through the federal system. So it's kind of interesting how they get people into the system, especially with like the student loan issue and people basically paying for decades on that. So
yeah, I'm not sure how they're or how you're attempting to connect the student loan debt with the income tax, but yeah, the whole system's interwoven or interlocked. But you're probably aware, I'm assuming you might be, since you speak so well on so many of the other issues of the times there and the Articles of Confederation. You're probably aware that the IRS, like so many other government agencies, is a corporation. And it's actually not really governmental. You know, so a lot of these agencies are actually corporations in themselves, and they're not really even part of the, quote, government.
Right. And I think that's kind of what becomes clear to me, and I know a lot of people, you know, love the Constitution and love a lot of that, but with the founding or the creation of the Constitution and your Bill of Rights, like you said, it's basically the creation of a corporate structure which the states are agreeing to be under. So I think we are seeing this both, you know, locally. I served on a school board for 6 years, so I always saw like the local, like the push and pull between, well, if we take federal money, we have to use the federal curriculum, or we have to, you know, use their school books, or we have
to.
And then we fall down that whole rabbit hole versus, hey, if we live within our means and we use the funds that we get from the local taxes, which is ample, we wouldn't have to abide by, you know, basically buying Common Core school books, et cetera. And this was several years ago. Now things have gotten even more insane with, let's say, the public school system as an instance, because most people, their local taxes still do go to the school district as far as that goes. Huge amount. And most of it goes to administration. It doesn't even go to the teachers or their retirement.
Right, right. Now, a lot of teachers, not all, but a lot of teachers do okay in their retirement, although I'm sure it varies state to state or district to district, whatever it is they're making while they're working. You know, some do better than others. But yeah, you're exactly correct in terms of there's no amount of money that can actually buy somebody a good education, because it's mostly self-directed. In other words, you know, a teacher can stand up and use the best physical, you know, facilities and use their best teaching methods all day long, every day. But it's, you know, it's who the students are, you know, and what sort of families they come from and what sort of expectations are in the home that would determine how anybody performs academically. And it's just laughable that we think that we can buy or spend a lot of money and get a good education, because there's many countries that are much poorer than the United States in terms of per capita. And they do better academically than we do. So, yeah, it's just another way of stealing from us, unfortunately.
Well, I did want to tie in like the federal student loan program to this, talking about, I think in the 1990s, they started the federal student loan program. And basically, people could be taking out loans from the federal government to pay the schools. And then once the colleges realized that they could get all this federal money, which is like what we're seeing right now on a macro level, they just raised tuition every single year. They raised tuition more and more. And so something that would cost, you know, a couple thousand dollars is now hundreds of thousands of dollars for a degree. And what are you getting from it? So that's a similar.
Exactly.
Thing, right.
Yes. No, precisely. And I got another recommendation that I want you to jot down, and I tell you it is a must see, The College Conspiracy. And that still should be on YouTube. It may not be, but if you search for that, you should find it on some video platform. But The College Conspiracy, if you've not seen that, it's quite the eye opener. By the way, very similar to The Light Bulb Conspiracy. If you've never seen something called The Light Bulb Conspiracy, that is absolutely fascinating. And because there was a conspiracy to make light bulbs have a much shorter life than they otherwise would. so people would continue to buy light bulbs when they went bad or when they, when
oh,
they, when
yeah.
they failed.
Okay. I haven't
yeah,
seen that. I've heard about that, though, like with planned obsolescence, that term.
Right. Yeah, and they go into other things besides the light bulb, but that was one of the first ones. But yeah, printers. Printers is a perfect example
yes.
where they put in there, in the design, or the, I think it might even be in the chip itself, a certain amount of time or a certain amount of print functions before it fails. And so the light bulb conspiracy goes into all of that. It's not just about the light bulbs, but what's interesting is the light bulb itself. And in the film, they show a light bulb from, I believe, either the late 1800s or the early 1900s that's still in use today. that's how well they could make a light bulb if they wanted to.
Well, this is why I'm so concerned about, like, the green agenda and stuff like that. You know, I see locally where I'm at all these solar panels and everything going up, and these are the electric batteries and, you know, that are used with cars. And we know all this stuff is made basically to fail. Like you said, the planned obsolescence, the electric batteries that they use for cars are absolutely atrocious. I mean, it's really insidious if you think about they're making these, this technology just built to fail.
And it would require many shows with many more people who are much more expert on the technology than I am. However, my assessment is it's deliberately the wrong direction, because the making use of a large battery. Because when you think about it, there's a guy that I think probably back in the late 80s, he invented his own little electric car, basically using a magnet, big magnet and generator. Because essentially, the battery in your car, average, you know, just a combustion engine car, just needs a fairly small battery just to start it, just to turn it over. But once the motor is running, the generator or the alternator powers everything. And so what they've done is, you know, because you only can have so here's what I would be saying, is that they would be able to have, and I believe men have invented various technologies to run on essentially a generator or an alternator, so you don't need a big battery, because once you get that thing going, it's going to generate its own current, its own power. But they deliberately went the direction of a large battery, because that's a top-down, you know, corporate-controlled kind of a monopoly that people couldn't take advantage of, and they wouldn't have, you know, any facility or ability to, you know, have that, you know, themselves in their own garages and their own workshops. You know, that's the kind of thing where, you know, you need a large infrastructure to keep that thing going, which means lots of money, lots of investment, and basically something to sell to people when those batteries eventually will go bad. And I've heard various estimates of their life, you know, who's really to know the truth about it. But yeah, it's deliberately the wrong direction. Because if you've ever watched, and I have, believe me, spent so much time binge watching all these alternative energy vehicles that have been tinkered with and built by people going all the way back to the 80s. And where are they now? You know, they're all gone. And instead we have these huge, like you say, these huge batteries in these cars. And it's deliberately, in my opinion, the wrong way to go on purpose.
Well, I think you're absolutely right about the patents and history of the patent office. It was actually started, I just looked it up, 1790, and it was put into the Constitution, the part of creating the patent office, July 31st, 1790, part of the patent system to support intellectual property when the United States recognized in the Constitution. So, like you said, there'll be a guy. And we've seen this, like you said, for decades, even going back further, obviously, people just tinkering in their garage and inventing a water fueled battery or something, making their own car. They apply for a patent, think that they can make it, sell it, you know, the American dream, become a businessman. It gets taken, usurped, whatever. And it never sees the light of day. And sometimes it becomes dangerous for those people to openly show this technology. So I think in a lot of ways, unfortunately, connecting this once again, what I've seen with a lot of the Constitution, it is meant to kind of consolidate a lot of this corporate structure. I know a lot of people are going to think I'm like anti-American or something. I just want people to look at the Articles of Confederation and then the Constitution and what our rights are. Really, like you said, I'll have to watch Clint Richardson's documentary. I know people have talked about his book Straw Man and stuff like that in the past. I still haven't put the time aside to do that. So.
No, it's a must. And you can make the time. I'm fond of saying for many decades now, my favorite saying is that we're all given the same amount of one thing, and that's time. All our other gifts are different, but we all have the same amount of time, which is 168 hours every week. That's 7 days times 24 hours a day. So with 168 hours each and every week, then 3 hours into a documentary doesn't seem so daunting.
Right. I mean, you can just be watching television, you know, or just which is 90% commercials or something. I'm like you. I like to binge watch documentaries and stuff like that too. And I think that's a lot of us. I think that it's in some ways it has kind of changed the culture, like the subset. There are people who try to seek out that type of stuff. So it's definitely been interesting to see kind of like a split in society of people who watch that kind of stuff and find interest, especially over like the past 10 years or so. And then the people who haven't done that at all.
Before we run out of time, let me give you another quick recommendation. I'm sure you've heard of him, but a researcher by the name of Mike Gaddy, G-A-D-D-Y. He's got quite a body of work on Revolution Radio as well as now Free Radio.
Yeah.
And he spent a lot of time going into the Articles of Confederation. I'm sure he and you would have a lot of common ground, and I couldn't recommend a lot of his shows on the Articles of Confederation versus the Constitution more highly. It's quite something. And like I said, but you so far have, in my opinion, done a lot of great groundwork, the kind of work that a lot of people don't do looking into things. So you're to be congratulated for that.
Thanks, Paul. Yeah, I hope you well, actually, Jim Fetzer, I think Mike Gaddy's been on Dr. Fetzer's show before, and I've heard him. But Jim, I got started with my presentation on Bacon's Rebellion and like the conspiracy of that through his Jim's conspiracy work. So shout out to Jim.
Okay.
Be back next week. And thanks, Paul, for calling in. Nice to meet you.
Sure. Sure. No, for sure.
Bye. Thanks, everyone.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
we did not engage in conflict that was out of line with our mission.
Is it disloyal? Is it sedition? Is it treason to oppose the hands of tyranny? Never!
I will never send troops anywhere on a mission of that kind without telling them that if somebody shoots at them, they can darn well shoot back.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty! Oh, give me!
A dark cloud is finally lifting across the world as U.S. military intelligence and their